Dave White is doing the robot, and he is popping and locking and spinning around on his shoulders. It's amazing.
Linoleum knife.
Yeah, that was...
Ain't no stopping linoleum knife.
Yeah, no one does it better. Yeah, so the guy spinning around on the piece of cardboard there is Dave White, film critic for movies.com.
And Alonzo Duralde is the man in the suit that's trying to ruin my street way of life.
I'm throwing the fancy party introduce street dancing to the fancy rich people.
With your string quartet.
Yes.
And
a little weird shirt.
And a little weird shirt with a little weird tie.
Yeah.
But you can't take the street out of me and give me a lot of money. I don't need that. I'm from the street.
That's right.
Why are we talking about this?
Because I was watching.
Why did I just play vintage electro for our listeners?
Because Break-In was on TCM this weekend on TCM Underground.
And sometimes when it's the weekend and you're just doing things like I spent yesterday cleaning the floor of the kitchen. Well, I didn't spend all day yesterday doing that, but cleaning the floor with the under the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that space between the refrigerator and the stove.
Yes.
Of the floor where the rest of the floor is brown, and then the space between the refrigerator and the stove is gunky black.
Yes.
Well, that's gross, and it needs to be cleaned. And fortunately, we have one of the new energy efficient refrigerators that can be moved by just anybody. You know, like a child could move it away.
Right.
You
were also being unwell yesterday, but that's another story.
Well, a little bit, but you don't have to. You don't have to talk about.
All right, that's we were talking about our day.
No,
you know,
that's not the thing.
Okay,
we, no.
Fine. Sorry.
My bathroom habits do not need to be discussed.
I didn't get into
show.
Specifics about
you were going there.
No.
I'm
you,
talking about
you could have had a touch of the dropsy.
I'm talking about
the
how
vapors,
I was cleaning,
and you had to retire to
the
your fainting couch.
Of the kitchen and just, you know, doing some household chores. And
I was
you
watching.
You were supposed to be working.
I was working. I spent all day watching very earnest documentaries that are being submitted to the Sundance Film Festival.
Right. Guess what none of those documentaries are named?
Break-In.
Break-In.
Yeah, and I needed a break with some Break-In after.
So Break-In was on TCM.
Yeah.
And then we both wound up just sitting down and looking at it. For the entire
running time.
The entire running time.
It's catchy, that movie.
It's we, as we watched the movie, I guess we had discussed this before.
Probably, yeah.
I mean, we've known each other almost 17 years. Well, 16 and a half.
Yeah.
I've known you about 16 and a half years now, and I know we've discussed this at least one point.
Yeah,
at least once,
have.
But you and I were both in 1984 in different cities as young people working in multiplexes.
Right.
In the summer of 1984.
Yes.
And both of our theaters were showing Break-In.
Yes.
At the same time.
Mine had Break-In and Beat Street in two different houses.
Mine had Break-In and Purple Rain in two different houses.
Our
pandemonium.
Our manager
all the time.
Our manager got so fed up with the Break-In Beat Street craziness that when Purple Rain popped up, he was like, oh, no. You could the other multiplex down the highway can show that one. We're done here.
Was there an option to book Purple Rain at your theater?
I heard all this third hand. I wasn't like
I see.
You know, but from what I heard, because Break-In and Beat Street was really labor intensive with the kids and the craziness.
Nonstop kids. Would come to I worked at the General Cinema Prestonwood in Sackowitz Village on Beltline Road in Dallas, Texas.
Right.
Anybody who knows that area knows that in the early 80s, Prestonwood Mall in Sackowitz Village, they were very close to the Galleria. They were very close to Valley View Mall. That was the happening place to be a shopper.
Right.
And so I worked at one of the awesome General Cinema 4-screen multiplexes in Prestonwood Village, right next to the gelato store, where the sons' skater kids in the Black Flag t-shirts would bring us free gelato, and we would give them free movie tickets, like on the DL.
On the sly, yeah. Okay.
We got break-in, and those kids, the break-in audience was all 10-year-olds, and they would come back again and again. They would come back like 2, 3, 4 times, and they would bring their little boom boxes, not huge ones because they were children, but like they would bring their little boom boxes and cassette players into the theater with them so that they could record the soundtrack. And we were supposed to, I remember my boss, who was 2 years younger than me.
Of course.
Yeah, my 17-year-old assistant manager.
Right.
Who insisted we call him by the name Mr. Blah Blah, whatever the hell his last name was. I'm sorry. He'd be like, you can't let kids bring those tape players in. It's illegal to tape the movie. And I was like, really? Who cares? Who cares? No. I would see kids do it. I'd be like, you're not supposed to have that in here. And they'd be like, sorry. And then they would turn it off. And then I'd walk away and they would turn it back on. Like, I'm not going to kick a 10-year-old child out of break-in who's giving our theater a lot of business, like seen it 3 times.
Well, somebody took a dump in our break-in house. That was, things got really, it was pandemonium in there. I was working at the National 6 on Old National Highway in College Park, Georgia. And it's funny, I was 17, and our assistant manager, I think, was 19, and was engaged to marry one of the girls in the box office.
Oh, good.
And
that's adorable.
I remember at the end of the summer, he asked me if I was really sure that I wanted to go to college.
Because it was such a great career ahead of him.
Because he thought I had real assistant manager potential.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm haunted to this day.
You could have been a big
as to whether or not I made the right decision.
Does that theater chain still exist?
I don't even know. It was Story Theaters, Storey. I'll have to look them up and see.
You need to look them up, because if they still exist, you could be, by this point in your life, you would be the CEO, practically. Like, you would move yourself all the way up to the top in a place like that. Because you're not a knucklehead.
But I think that anybody who
reviews, most of the time,
thank you. Anybody who reviews movies for a living should have had to have worked in a multiplex at some point, just to see the horror of what goes on behind the scenes.
The horror of audiences.
Well, yeah, that too. But like, I look now at how they have those little, you know, prepackaged individual nacho cups, and I just remember how we had to, like, you know, nowadays
I don't get nachos at the
moment. I don't either. But if you, have you not noticed when anybody buys them, you get this little plastic tray of tortilla chips, and in the corner there's like a little like a little yogurt cup.
Oh, really?
But it's nacho cheese that's been heated up in a microwave.
Got it.
Back in my day, in the caveman times, we had a big can of this gloop that we had to dump into a crock pot and add water to it.
That's disgusting.
Yeah,
we didn't have nachos at our
time. Oh, God, we had nachos and they were really
candy,
popular.
Popcorn, soda, lemonade. And the biggest hassle was cleaning the lemonade machine.
And we had 2 flavors of like high C or whatever that did
I wish we had.
That did not come out of the soda machine. They had the like that cafeteria style where it sprays up.
That's what I'm talking about. That was our lemonade machine.
Right, yeah. We had like red and orange.
Yeah. I'm blank now. I know you and I have discussed this before on an earlier episode, that when our theater got Purple Rain, our manager, because we got Purple Rain before break-in, I think.
No.
Are you sure? How is that?
Purple Rain was like August, and okay, break-in was like May or June.
I guess then what we did was we anticipated, when I say we, I mean the bosses, because I was all indignant, and I think I have discussed this before when it happened on an earlier show. When we got Purple Rain 2 days before the movie opened, I walked in for my shift, and our manager was changing out the soda machines, and he was taking out, he was taking Dr. Pepper out, and he was taking
in Dallas
something else out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he was switching it to get Big Red and grape.
Mm.
And I was like, Why are we switching out? I mean, I wasn't complaining because grape soda.
I was going to say, you've never turned down
a grape soda. I've never turned down a grape soda ever in my life. That's my favorite soda of all time. So I was stoked that we were getting grape soda.
Did you think this was racist somehow?
Well, I said, why do we have grape soda? Inside, I'm thinking, all right, we have grape soda. But like I said, why are we switching the sodas? He goes, black people love grape soda. And I was like, that's not true. That's racist. And he's like, watch. And I was like, I was so angry. Like that they were anticipating black people wanting different soda, you know, than white people. Because
that's just demographics.
Our theater mostly attracted white people. Uh-huh. Like it was North Dallas,
right?
You know, here's how few black people I remember being in that theater. Tony Dorsett came to our theater one day,
uh-huh.
and I thought, oh, that's a black guy. Like I didn't even.
That was what stood out.
Well, I didn't know who he was.
Right, of course.
Because I don't care about football.
Right.
I really did not know who he was, and that did not sit well with Tony Dorsett. Because he handed me a $100 bill that I couldn't change, and I was like, I can't change this. I don't have it. Because I was in the box office.
Right.
And he was like, well, just keep it, and I'll give you get my change later. And I said, okay, well, I need to get your information. He was like, so what's your name? And he goes, Dorsett. And I go, two T's. Like I'm writing it down.
And celebrities need a U every so often. I leave
the box office.
No, I don't know who you are.
I leave the box office and I go to the concession and the girl to hand it to the girl at the concession. And I said, you need to bring this up to Roy. That was our 17-year-old assistant manager.
Mr. So-and-so.
Mr. Whatever his name was. I go, you need to bring this up to Roy because that dude paid me with a $100 bill and he needs his change at the end of the movie. She goes, oh my God, that was Tony Dorsett. That was Tony Dorsett. That was Tony Dorsett. Don't you know who Tony Dorsett is? I was like, no. I don't watch sports. She goes, but he plays with the Dallas Cowboys. You live in Dallas. And I was like, look, I've only lived here a year and a half. My family moved there in 83. I said, I have never paid attention to the Dallas Cowboys other than seeing North Dallas 40. Which is a great movie, by the way.
And the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders on the Love Boat.
On the Love Boat, yeah. North Dallas 40 is a rad movie, by the way.
But it's not about the Cowboys.
To this day, it is totally about the Cowboys.
It is, but not... They call it, for legal purposes, they're called
Cowboys. I understand. I understand.
But yes. Did you see Semi-Tough?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I love sports movies. We're going to talk about that in a second.
Okay.
I love sports movies.
Just not sports.
I don't give a damn about sports. I just like sports movies. I know we haven't started talking about the movie.
No, but we're rambling. This is trip down memory lane is fascinating.
She goes, I can't believe you don't know who that is. I go, why should I? I go, just because I don't like football and don't care about football and don't watch football, I don't have to know who anyone is in football.
No, I know. I've always been the same.
And now, since then, you know, sports have really super invaded the culture in a way that even non-sports fans
understand.
Like, I know the names of people. I will recognize their faces and be like, oh, yeah, that's blah, blah, and he plays for the blah, blah, blah team of this blah, blah sport, whatever.
That's more than I know.
You know, I can do that.
It's funny that you mentioned...
Well, getting back to the grape soda.
I was just going to say, it's funny that you mentioned Tony Dorsett's $100 bill because the biggest celebrity that ever came to my movie theater during my tenure there, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter showed up because, you know, their daughter Amy went to my high school, which was nearby.
Right.
And apparently after dropping her... After dropping her off, they went to the theater to see Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes. And he paid with a $100 bill.
God. Famous people. Look, if there are any famous people listening to this podcast,
I highly doubt.
I know there aren't, but just carry some 20s.
Well, I think with ATMs, please, it's more
just
common.
Bring some 20s because no one cares. No one cares that you're rich. If they recognize you, they already know that you're famous, and therefore you are also rich. And so,
although movie tickets cost more now, so breaking 100 is probably less of a big deal.
No, not unless you're banned for like a family of five.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, did the grape soda sell?
Oh, it sold out.
Okay.
Like I barely got any grape soda. I was kind of angry at the black people. I was like, look, A, you're confirming my company's racist.
It's not racist.
Stereotypes. B, why is there no more grape soda left for me? They drank more grape soda than red, than Big Red. They drank more than the Big Red. And here was the craziest thing. It was as if there was like a siren call or something because here was this movie theater that attracted mostly a white audience. And then suddenly Purple Rain opens and no white people go see it the first week or two. It's all black people. Like the entire audience is all black people.
Right.
And I'm like, do y'all all live around here? Like, do you just not come to this theater? Do we just show movies you don't like? It was this weird summer where I was trying to, I had to question all these things about like race and who liked what and what movies people saw and what sodas they drank. It was a very confusing time for
me. That was a really great movie summer, though, I have to say. I mean, I know I sort of think of it nostalgically because it was the summer after I graduated from high school and all, but seriously, that summer was Ghostbusters, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Gremlins, Star Trek 3, Red Dawn. There was like a lot
of... Was that the one with the whales?
No, that's 4.
Okay.
There were a lot of really fun movies that summer, and it was a good movie summer.
Yeah, it was. I just, you know... I was just fascinated constantly by the Purple Rain.
Well, and I think
phenomenon.
I think just by going to see
Breakin',
a movie with Breakin'
was a mixed race audience.
Yeah,
Breakin' was all these little kids.
A movie
white,
with
black,
purple in the
Mexican,
title makes you
want to
have grape soda. I think
maybe
that's part of the trigger.
Maybe Breakin' had a mixed race audience.
Not
they
in
were
my theater.
All 9 years old.
In my theater, it was all black people.
They were all nine. For they all had little cardboard mats that they would spin on their heads.
Yes,
in the
definitely.
Lobby.
In the lobby. Yes.
And then I had to hustle them out of the lobby. Yes. For that, too, my manager would be like, you can't let them
And then
they'd
do it on the front
the
sidewalk
lobby.
Instead,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But I went to Purple Rain opening weekend.
Like, why can't we let them do this in the lobby? It's cool to watch them do this in the lobby.
I went to Purple Rain opening weekend in Columbia, South Carolina. I was visiting a friend of mine, and we and our group were the only white people in the theater.
To see Breakin'?
No, to see Purple Rain.
To see Purple Rain.
Yeah.
Well, eventually...
Which eventually crossed over.
We had Purple Rain all summer. Like, this was back in the day when movies would just linger
okay,
in theaters.
Okay, again, this
for...
movie opened in August, I remember.
No, it did not open in August. Well, if it opened in August, we had it through, like, the end of October or something.
Okay.
Because it was...
It played a long time.
It played a long time, and the audiences eventually... At least on our theater. Maybe in other theaters.
Because the songs became hits on the radio.
In our theater, the audiences began to become like much more mixed in terms of their racial makeup. But the first 2 weeks, it was like all black folks.
Yeah, and nobody. And nowadays, nobody thinks of that as being like a black movie. That's like a movie everybody
drinking
likes.
All the grape soda. I will always resent them for drinking all that grape
soda.
Now,
did you, in your theater, did you have to like... carry those super heavy tanks of the syrup?
Yes.
God, those were the worst. That's the other thing the kids have so easy now. They have those little, you see those little cardboard boxes that they have now?
Yeah, they're smaller.
With the
and
tubes?
I think they're more concentrated or
yeah,
something.
Something like that. But, oh,
we had
those God,
huge,
those tanks.
Those very heavy tanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we had, you know, two-wheelers to cart them around.
Right. But and those really complicated little things you had to push down and turn the thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ugh. Ugh. And we didn't like make all of our popcorn fresh in the lobby.
I'll tell you something else though.
I would do entire 8-hour shifts where I just stood at this machine and made popcorn and filled giant garbage bags with it.
Let me tell you something else. As much pandemonium as the Purple Rain Breakin' audiences combined were, nothing was worse than when the Hitchcock movies got reissued in the 80s.
Yeah.
I don't remember now which one
it was
we
like,
got.
Rear
Window.
It was
Rear
Window, Vertigo, The Trouble with Harry, Rope, and...
I think we got The Trouble with Harry or Rope.
Okay.
Or Vertigo. I don't remember now. It wasn't Rear Window. It was equal pandemonium.
But old white
this
people?
Was all old white people.
And they're the worst.
And they are the worst because they do nothing but complain.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to...
You can say...
Can I?
I think...
Can you say bitch on a...
I think
clean,
I
They
think
did
you
nothing
can.
But bitch all the time. like the Purple Rain and Breakin' audiences were rowdy as hell, but they weren't mean.
Yeah. There's like, that's a definite difference. Like I know what you mean.
Like the Hitchcock audience was, again, packed theater.
Yeah, there's nobody as crabby and entitled as old white people.
But it's just the meanest, and the concession... Like, I was behind concession, and we were booking it behind concession. We were like a machine of, like,
right.
of efficiency.
Cranking it out.
It still wasn't fast enough.
No, no, of course.
They'd show up 5 minutes before the movie.
Exactly, yeah. They don't show up early enough, and then they complain that they don't magically whisk through the concession line in time to get the perfect seat as well. That's how have they all been taken? I got here 5 minutes before it started.
I remember saying to my manager, like, can we just bring Purple Rain back? Like, I know it's been out for a year and a half. Can we just bring Purple Rain back?
Now, this was a movie that we showed that summer, but you have a much funnier story about Rhinestone.
Let's talk about that some other time. We need to talk about the actual movies.
Okay, you're right. We've spent quite a bit of time on this.
Next time Sylvester Stallone makes a movie,
we'll talk about Dolly Parton.
A listener has emailed us to tell us that we have not fought sufficiently about Columbiana.
Yeah, two listeners, actually. One because of which, happy birthday,
I went to Dallas, and you had Jen and Todd, and did they like it or not?
They did not.
Movie is rad.
All right, I suggest that we table this until it comes out on DVD, because that movie is kind of old now.
It's 3 weeks old.
Yeah, but we promise
awesome, and you're wrong.
When it comes out on DVD, we will have the throwdown
about
why
100,000%
why
wrong.
Dave White's head is lodged in his own anus when
about
it comes Columbiana, to
Columbiana, which is great.
No, it's ridiculous.
So ridiculously great.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. We promise.
All right, sports.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to start
Why don't you tell everyone about how wrong you are about Warrior? Oh, okay. Let's kick it off with you being wrong about something.
You are such a twit. Warrior, I think, has a lot going for it. It is a rousing sports movie. It is sort of like, actually merits the comparisons to Rocky in a lot of ways. It's also an interesting drama about messed up family dynamics. And how adult children of alcoholics try to work out their...
What are you trying to say?
That's what's in the movie. Try to work out their pasts. And, I think it's a movie that I have been recommending to people and that I listed my
review. Oh, are you?
Yes, I listed my review as
You're genuinely
fresh
recommending
on Rotten Tomatoes.
It. Oh, yeah?
However, mm-hmm. I recommend it with the caveat that for me...
Caveat. Fancy man.
Yes, I am
Amy
fancy.
Amy Carter went to high school with you. At your fancy high school.
That's right. We learned fancy words like caveat. Because I've got assistant manager material here. With the caveat that the ending doesn't work for me. But
for you.
For me.
Because
you're
wrong.
But lunkheads like Dave White and others
fine.
That I've talked to
fine.
Seem to love it.
If I'm a lunkhead, fine.
Well, good thing, because you are.
Well, it's about these two brothers.
Yes.
Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton.
Mm-hmm. I had forgotten Joel Edgerton was dreamy young Uncle Owen in the Star Wars prequels.
I don't remember. Anyway, but I'm supposed to remember what happened in the Star Wars prequels?
He was the
crappiest movies ever?
He was one of the highlights because he was really attractive.
I see.
He's the farmer
Fine.
Uncle that Luke Skywalker goes to
Fine.
Live with.
Yes, I know who Uncle Owen is in Star Wars, in the real Star Wars.
All right,
I
well,
know who Uncle
he
Owen
plays
is.
Young Uncle Owen
All right,
in the
great.
Prequels.
So,
and he was in Animal Kingdom.
He's not Uncle Owen anymore.
No.
He's in Warrior.
Yes.
Opposite Tom Hardy, he plays Tom Hardy's brother.
Right.
Nick Nolte is their dad. 1,000 days sober, which is almost 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
Almost three years. And because he is 1,000 days sober, he somehow believes
he's going to be forgiven.
He should be forgiven for being like never not sober or never sober and always abusive and hitting everybody and chasing the mom away, and the mom ends up dying
in squalor.
Yeah, just like he destroys this family. But he's that same kind of uncomprehending, sober person that an expression I've come to learn in my life is dry drunk.
He's not a dry drunk.
Oh, he's a dry drunk.
How can you?
Yeah,
you can't be an AA and be a dry drunk. A dry
oh,
drunk?
Yes, you can.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
See, I always think of a dry drunk as somebody like George W. Bush who just stops.
You can be working those steps and still behaving like a drunk.
I see.
You're not working them right. You're not doing them thoroughly.
Okay.
I know something about this stuff.
You do.
And I'm not going to go into too many specific family details, but this movie, I will give this. Maybe I'm a little psychologically underdistanced from this movie.
You might be.
On a personal level.
Yes.
But I believe the movie is smarter than other movies about messed up families because of alcoholism and abuse. I think that that what this movie doesn't do elevates it. It doesn't follow the formula.
Right.
It doesn't follow the we yell at each other until we hug.
Right.
You know, and you weren't there for me, blah, 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 blah. Now, they say these things to each other, they say these things to each other with a sort of like lumpen bitterness,
right,
with almost no affect at all. The guys, the only person who borders on the hysterical in terms of like trying to get the family, you know, back together again, is Nick Nolte. Every
right.
once in a while, he's like, "Well, I've been sober 3 years," and everyone else is like, "Yes, yeah, so what?"
Exactly.
And like the sons are having none of it. They're training. They're both training to be fighters again. Tom Hardy resuming his fighting training.
Yeah, he'd been
in the Iraq War
as a kid, and
he'd been in the Iraq War, and all of his units killed by friendly fire.
Is it friendly fire?
It is friendly fire.
Okay, I didn't remember that.
He alone survived a friendly fire situation.
And then
he did something else that I'm not going to give away.
And then Joel Edgerton had been a fighter. You know, had hoped actually that after young Tom Hardy left with their mom, that Nick Nolte would train him and pay attention to him. But that never happened. But
right.
anyway, he was a fighter anyway. Now he's a science teacher, and he's losing his house, and his daughter's had heart problems. So he's getting back in the ring to try and make some money.
These guys have been destroyed by their family. These two guys have been destroyed by their family, and betrayed on two different levels by their country. One of them in a war,
one of them by the economy,
and one of them by the economy and the evil, you know, health system that we have in the United States. And so they are not only having to fight in a metaphoric way for their own brotherhood, but they're literally having to fight for their livelihoods. And then they have to fight each other at the end. Now, that's all I'm going to say about the plot, but it's a really effective movie because it has all the sports movie beats. It's not doing anything on a deeper level, really. It's not doing anything.
It's an old-fashioned movie.
It's not pushing any envelopes in terms of like cinema or
narrative.
How it looks or narrative or the subject of male violence or the visual aspects of bodies, you know,
in combat
or any kind of like motion, you know, violent motion. It does, you know, what an old fashioned movie does. But it does it so powerfully and so effectively and so movingly that, yes, I cried. And you know what? I went to see it with Jen Yamato, my former fellow film critic at Movies.com, who's mm-hmm. now at Movie Line. She was seeing it for the second time. And after it was over, she goes, "I had to see this for the second time to make sure that I thought it was an actual good movie because I cried too much the first time I saw it." And I was like, "Don't tell anybody." Because the movie had been over like 60 seconds. I go, "You don't tell anybody this, but I just cried too." Of course, now I'm telling everybody.
Yes, you are.
And I told everybody in my review. Because I don't care.
I didn't cry. Okay. Because for me, the big final battle doesn't work dramatically in a lot of different ways. But up to that point, I thought it was really compelling. I mean, I think Christy Lemire, we were talking about it on What the Flick this week, I thought she had a valid point in that it is too long and that there are things that are extraneous things that could be cut. You could cut the Russian super fighter that one of them has to beat.
Sure.
You could cut like the stuff with the kids at the high school cheering him on. You could cut some of there's a lot of filigree that doesn't need to be there.
That's rousing.
You know, they keep cutting to the billionaire who's funding this big fight.
Well, that's the director.
Who's played by, I found out later, it's played by the director, Gavin O'Connor.
And
they cut to him so many times, I thought, is he going to like turn up in the last act and make somebody take a dive or do something nefarious?
Why is he
in this movie so much?
Dude, he was in Tumbleweeds.
I know.
He played the boyfriend
but he looks way different in this.
Yeah, he used to weigh like 60 pounds more or something.
Yeah, I mean,
when he was in Tumbleweeds.
Yeah, he was a big brute.
Radically different looking.
Anyway,
guy.
Gavin O'Connor is a good choice to direct this because here's a guy who has made his name mainly through sports movies. He did Miracle, he did Pride and Glory, but started his career.
Pride and Glory is not a sports movie,
isn't it?
No, cop movie.
Oh, oops. Okay, well, yeah. Miracle then. Pride and Glory sounds like a sports movie. And that, but he started his career with this indie movie, Tumbleweeds. You may recall Janet McTeer got an Oscar nomination.
You may not recall.
They might.
Who remembers that movie except you and me?
She got an Oscar nomination. It didn't. Right. It's not like some indie that, you know, opened in two cities and then disappeared. I mean, it right. was out there for a while, right. and you know, it was about sort of a rambling mother, you know, who kind of, as soon as things get complicated in one city, she just pulls up stakes and leaves, and the daughter that she sort of drags along
ruins her daughter's life.
Yeah, another movie that Dave White felt awfully close to. So anyway, this movie kind of plays to his
strengths. My life turned out fine, by the way.
Yes,
I just want everyone to know there's nothing wrong now.
So anyway, this movie definitely plays to Gavin O'Connor's strengths, and I think the cast is really terrific. In my review on The Wrap, I said that like I was getting a lot of undertones of Humphrey Bogart in Tom Hardy's performance, and of Cagney from Joel Edgerton, and I certainly, these are not names I easily bandy about, but I think they really bring that kind of intensity and that kind of charm to the roles.
What's really rad about Tom Hardy is that his face can change.
Yeah, he's a real chameleon.
He can look all like pouty and pretty and Rock and Roll. I think his character name in Rock and Roll was like Handsome Bob or something like that.
Yeah.
Like he's pillowy lipped, you know,
sylph-like,
pretty guy. And then again in like Inception, he's like Mr. Dapper Devonair,
right,
calling people darling, and, you know, and then like in Bronson, he's a psychotic maniac, equally like pumped up and like jacked up and muscular and brutal and mean and, you know, violent. Same in this. I swear he must have done steroids to be in this movie, because if you look in certain shots, he's got those weird, like, lumpy neck muscles that are coming up in the back. I'm like, that's only steroid dudes that have that.
I don't know.
I'm not accusing him of anything, but, you know, I mean, like, he seems to be the kind of guy that would be, like, committed enough to changing his body for something that he would be like, yeah, put me on steroids for 3 months so that I can be in this movie. You know,
maybe.
Make me look crazy.
I mean, look, if Christian Bale can, you know, do his crazy body mods over the years, I'm sure Tom Hardy manages it too. And Nick Nolte, you know, who gives a really just painful performance, mm-hmm. and he's really good. It's really, neither he nor Tom Hardy ever make any effort to like do something to ensure the audience is going to love them.
Right.
Like, they really don't care. And they're allowing themselves to not be loved by the
audience. I want to see this again. I want to go again.
Well, you do that.
I'm going to do it.
So I like it. I just didn't love it the way that a lot of people I have been talking to love it. Because for me, the ending doesn't work. But, you know, it might for you. It certainly did for Dave White.
I could have done with a little less of the tap out, bros. Sideshow Bob hair guys.
I at one point I wrote down Joel Edgerton's sponsor is Ugly Shirts.
Contagion. I know I shouldn't have laughed out loud. The opening shot is a black screen, and all you hear is Gwyneth Paltrow going. But that's how it opens. And I just went, because you know,
Gwyneth Paltrow is Camille.
She's going to die in like 5 minutes. And I love how there are all these shots of like bar peanuts and subway handles and doorknobs.
Doorknobs with snot smears on them.
Glasses and restaurants and things. And you're like, oh, I don't want to touch anything.
I know. You want to like put the hazmat suit on and just.
I have this thing. Gwyneth Paltrow has always been really just princessy to me. I have not been into her.
Yeah.
The minute she won the Oscar, I was like,
she became thoroughly intolerable.
You are going to be a permanent pain. I can feel this now. You're going to be a permanent pain, And
at some point she sensed
for
that.
A long time I really did feel like that's kind of what she was, just a pain.
Yeah, and she naming the kids Apple, and you know,
no, that's not what bothered me at all. That's been recent. Then I saw her host Saturday Night Live and be really funny.
Is it recently or when?
No, this is like a while back, years ago.
Okay.
So our host Saturday Night Live years ago, she was really funny. Remember they did that lockjaw people with the Hamptons kind of people? And she's like, oh, darling. You know, like she did that. And I remember when she did that, I thought, she knows how to do that a little too well. But she's funny doing it. And so I thought, okay, I get that you're still this WASP princess.
Right.
This, you know, preppy down to your bones.
And I adore Blythe Danner. Let's be clear about that.
But
she's
but
great.
Now you're making me laugh. So I'll hate you a little less. Well, now, in the past 3 years.
Two or three years, yeah. She's been aggressively making us love her.
Aggressively being... Well, I think she hired a team.
Yeah.
I think she hired a
this
team...
This isn't accidental.
...of consultants and like...
Image.
The cast of Breakin'. Like, whoever she hired to come in...
Lucinda Dickey came in with
Shabadoo. And be like, all right, we're going to teach you how to be a little less...
Irritating.
Irritating and pill-like. Mm. And suddenly she seems so cool all the time.
Like, she's on Glee.
Which is not a cool show.
No, but she is cool on it.
She brings this sort of, like, if the show was, if she became a permanent cast member, I would actually watch Glee every week now. Because she is so funny when she's on
she
there.
Just,
she
just
won that Wallace Simpson impersonation.
Which we still quote, yes. She just won an Emmy as best guest.
Oh, did she win an Emmy for that?
Yeah, being a guest star on a comedy.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, and I think she deserved it. Because she's been real funny on Glee.
She sang with CeeLo on the Grammys when he was dressed as Elton John on the Muppet Show.
She sent out a really profane tweet about the new Coldplay CD a few weeks back. That's really funny.
She did that crazy Country Strong movie.
That was a terrible movie.
She's all like wearing smeared eyeliner and being drunk and singing country.
If anyone knows Gwyneth Paltrow, just tell her, don't take this the wrong way, but watching her die in Contagion was one of the movie highlights of the year for me. Because she goes for it in a crazy, overacting, but awesome way. Like
it is not like
convulsions and seizures and foaming at the mouth.
Yeah.
And
next week we're going to be talking about the new Gus Van Sant movie, Reckless.
Yeah.
This is the complete opposite as far as screen deaths go. Yeah, she's convulsing and there's coming out of her mouth and she rides the whole thing. And then
are we allowed to talk about the thing that happens?
I don't think it's not a big spoiler.
Is that a big spoiler?
I don't think so.
Okay, well
they autopsy
her in the movie, and she's lying there all gross looking and dead, and they peel her skull.
The top of her head off.
And they just flap it on her face.
So it's like this blonde hair with like meat underneath. And then there's brains.
Yes. And I turned to you and I said, oh, damn it. Now she is the coolest person alive. Because you want to make me love you? Lose all your vanity.
Get scalped in
5 minutes of screen time and then let them peel your scalp back. Yeah. I'm now smitten.
You are Team Paltrow.
I am Team Paltrow now, thanks to this movie, which is a great, fun movie.
It's, yeah.
I'm totally OCD and germphobic, and I was in heaven watching this movie because it just confirmed.
Everything you've ever thought.
Everything I've ever thought. Like, I wash my hands about, I don't know, 12 times a day. I think that's normal.
I wash my hands back and forth. I wash my hands.
I do. I take a lot of precautions with germy, gross things in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm right.
Well, I'm glad this movie made you feel better. It's entertaining. It's, you know, it gives you that sort of great disaster movie thing of getting to vicariously experience a horrible situation from the safety of your movie seat. But it, even though it has this sort of all-star cast, it doesn't do that Irwin Allen histrionic, you know, people screaming and rescuing each other at the last second kind of thing.
It's kind of cold.
It's a cool kind of, you know, constrained movie. And it really kind of spells out like, how would this go? It was interesting to see in the context of having been watching Torchwood Miracle Day, which is about what would happen if people on Earth stopped.
Which everybody says sucks except you.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Everyone I know who's watching is like, I hate this, and you're the one that's still up
on board. The finale was on this week. I thought it was really good. The show kind of had ups and downs, but the finale was really good. Anyway, it sort of shows you, like, well, how would governments respond to, you know, everyone not dying? How would drug companies respond to it? Blah, blah, blah.
Greedily.
Yeah, of course. And so this movie kind of goes in that direction as well and just sort of, like, takes you step by step through the processes of things.
You would all get dropped by your insurance so fast.
I have to admit, I liked the first half of the movie more than the second half of the movie because I think that some of the resolutions are kind of... just sort of dramatically unsatisfying. Like, I think the Marion Cotillard character, they really don't know what to do. Like, she disappears for a long chunk of the
good
movie.
Good chunk of the movie, yeah.
And then when they finally sort of end up her stuff, it's sort of like, I don't know.
Like, they kidnap her, and by the end of it, you're like, she seems to sort of enjoy having been kidnapped.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
She's teaching these little Chinese kids in a remote village. It's like the Lost Horizon. Kellerman and Lost Horizon.
Yeah, or Liv Ullmann. But yeah, Liv Ullmann, whatever. Why is a French woman teaching Chinese kids in English, you know? Anyway, just things like that. It's sort of like, but nonetheless, it's an entertaining movie, and it's, you know, and yes, if you are remotely germ phobic, it will be like your dream / nightmare come true.
Oh yeah, there's mucus in this movie. This is the mucusiest movie of the year, I'd say.
I love Kate Winslet. She's just so, like...
Super Winslet.
She is
Super Winslet in this movie. And she's everywhere at once, helping everybody at once.
She has this really sort of flat, you know, American accent, but she's just, like, getting things done, you know.
You turned to me, I wrote this down, you turned to me in the film and said, this is like the bummer Valentine's Day.
Well, yeah, because apparently the way that Soderbergh is able to get this cast of stars is that they rarely intersect in this movie, so he can get them for like 2 weeks and get everything he needs out of them, which is the same premise that how Gary Marshall got his cast for Valentine's Day and the upcoming New Year's Eve is like, you have all these disparate stories in your ensemble. So, okay, I've got Robert De Niro for 4 days. Good, you know, and now he's in my movie, you know. So that was the connection.
Two more things.
Yes.
The action takes place right before Thanksgiving and all the way through Christmas.
Right.
Which makes it maybe... the most depressing Christmas movie of all time.
It's up there.
Can you think of one that's more depressing than this?
Deuce.
Okay. A movie that anyone except you or I or the people who happened to be at the LA County Museum of Art that night know anything about French cinema of the 40s. Anybody else? Any other movie but that?
Yeah, I don't know.
If you'd like to know about Deuce, D-E-U-C-E.
It's D-O-U-C-E.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. A French film of the 40s set on Christmas Eve. You should pick up Alonzo Duraldi's book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
I don't really talk about Deuce that much.
You don't?
It's in the appendix, but I didn't.
It didn't become its own entry?
No.
Why not?
I needed to see it again, and it's not available on
anywhere,
so that would have been impossible. And B, because it's not available anywhere, it didn't seem like there was any point in writing about it.
I forgot that you didn't put this in your book.
I consider it sort of a failing
on your part.
Well, look.
Because it's a great movie.
If it ever gets released on...
It's not even out on, like, Euro DVD?
I don't think so.
Wow.
I'll have to look.
That's really weird. There is a person in the credits named Spooky Stevens. What does this person do? Do you remember what the credit was?
I don't remember what Spooky does.
Some kind of credit. Oh, no. I think it was like a unit publicist.
Oh, I think you're right.
Yeah. So there's a publicist out there named Spooky Stevens. I got to be friends with this person. I don't care if they're male or female.
Love is kind of crazy with a spooky little girl.
Spooky.
Like you.
Hey, how come my parents didn't name me Spooky?
Had they known how you were going to turn out, I'm sure they would.
They could have. I mean, I would be a much radder person than I am. I mean, you name someone Dave White. That's like naming someone John Smith or Joe, you know.
But I think
Brown
that gave you something to overcome.
I guess. I had plenty of other things to overcome. Look at me.
Look, having a weird and unique name is no picnic either, let me tell you.
But what if your name was Spooky?
Well, that would be better.
Spooky Duraldi. I'm changing my name.
What's that line from Johnny Dangerously? Are you aware that your last name is an adverb?
Are you aware, Spooky Stevens, that your first name is Awesome? I bet it's a nickname, but still.
Probably. But you never know.
Wouldn't it be great if your parent, if this person's parent, male or female? I don't know if this person's male or female. Wouldn't it be great if their parents had named them Spooky?
I'm just imagining Sister Mary Ignatius saying, there is no
saint. Little brother
there
Grouchy.
There is no saint spooky.
I don't have a DVD recommendation.
We got two more movies to cover here.
Dude, what are the two more movies we have to cover?
Bucky Larson, Born to be a Star.
There's nothing to say. Seriously, there's nothing to say. Go to movies.com, read my review. Go to the rap, read his review. I can't bear to talk about this.
Yeah.
This blip of an event in my otherwise not terrible week.
It was a big chunk of my actually awful week, including the fact that we're recording this episode, incidentally, on Dave's laptop.
Because that's right.
Mine's in the shop.
My Valiant, super strong laptop.
We're hoping that it's working. It looks like it is. And Bucky Larson, Born to be a Star. The worst. And yeah, go read our reviews and you'll see why.
Not even fun to go see.
It wouldn't even be fun with friends and cocktails. Just when nothing.
When it comes on cable, TiVo it and fast forward to all the Kevin Nealon parts. He's in it about six scenes, I'd say. And he just screams bloody murder like a rage-filled jerk. About Bucky Larson stealing all the food in the house. But Bucky Larson isn't stealing the food in the house. Kevin Nealon is just a psychopath.
Right.
There's a funny movie starring Kevin Nealon bursting itself trying to get out of Bucky Larson.
I thought he was okay. I think you were just desperate to find anything.
That was my half a star.
It was Kevin Nealon?
It was for Kevin Nealon.
I see, okay. The other movie that opened this week in New York and next week in Los Angeles is We Were Here.
We Were Here. It's a documentary about San Francisco in the 80s.
In the early years of the AIDS pandemic.
When everybody was... Why do you say pandemic instead of epidemic? Am I not... Is there something I don't understand about the difference between those two words?
I forget the difference.
Because they use the word pandemic. I counted this. Uh-huh. They use the word pandemic once in We Were Here, and then they use epidemic all the other times they say it. And you consistently say pandemic when discussing the early years of AIDS, and I don't get... Do I not understand definitions of things?
I don't remember the specifics. I know that when I was at The Advocate, style dictated that we say pandemic and not epidemic. And I don't know the difference between those two words.
Who wrote The Advocate Style Guide? Because The Advocate Style Guide was weird. I remember I wrote for them for a little while, and the style guide
was... What was weird? The serial comma?
Yeah, the serial comma.
Oh, boo-hoo.
Serial comma. Oxford.
For all you Vampire Weekend fans.
I was always sort of like, I railed internally against the Oxford comma.
I got used to it after a while. Stockholm Syndrome about the... Shanghai Syndrome is what we said that Marion Cotillard has. I got Stockholm Syndrome about the Oxford comma. Anyway, we always said AIDS pandemic at The Advocate, so I just got into the habit of saying AIDS pandemic. I don't know what a pandemic even is, really, or how it's different from an epidemic.
In all the years you were at The Advocate, you didn't look up the difference between pandemic and epidemic. You just accepted the Advocate style guide without question.
I was in the arts and entertainment. I was in the arts and entertainment section. It didn't come up a lot.
Media gaze.
It's not like I was working at HIV Plus or something.
No. Well.
Anyway,
you could have asked them. They were just down the hall from you guys, owned by the same company.
Okay. Well, I didn't think to do it. Yeah. So anyway,
someone
like
was too busy playing solitaire
like
on his computer.
Like you would have. Anyway,
I would have.
David Weissman, who directed The Coquettes several years ago, this is his new film. And it's a really powerful documentary. And what's amazing is that
it's about people who lived.
Yeah, it's about the survivors.
It's about people who lived. It's about people who were there, who either got HIV and didn't die, or miraculously somehow did not get HIV, or were like there was a nurse.
Yeah, who was a lesbian, I think.
I don't know what she is.
Anyway, but she was definitely involved with the
community. She was definitely an early 70s feminist.
Yeah.
I don't know if she was a lesbian. She never says.
There's a picture of her hugging another woman. I couldn't tell if it was.
Ladies do that all the time.
I know. Anyway, but yeah, so it's a movie about people who survived those early years and who are still around to tell their stories. And in that documentary that I was in years ago called Fabulous, The Story of Queer Cinema, at the end of the movie, they ask everybody, like, what movies that haven't been made do you want to see? And Christine Vachon says, there's a really big story to be told about how AIDS affected the community and the just the devastating toll that it took. And I think this is really the first of the movies that I've seen to really kind of address that weren't made at the time. You know, this one actually
there were movies made at the time, like
common threads and sort of like life. But this one actually has a little bit of perspective to it. And because it's being told by people who are still alive, that inherently makes it less depressing than something like Silver Lake Life, where like everyone on camera drops dead at some point during the film.
They die on camera.
Yeah, I know. And it's just, oh God.
They die on camera. Yeah.
So,
Try to explain that to Matt actually the other night, because he'd never heard, I don't think he'd ever heard of the movie.
Yeah, no.
And I was like, this is a documentary where they die on camera. And then their friend has to finish the movie for them
because
the directors are dead before the movie's over.
Yeah. And I saw the movie in Silver Lake. It was really sad.
Yeah.
But anyway, so this movie, I think, you know, kind of brings it to a different perspective and really kind of reintroduces the conversation in a way, because after the retroviral, you know, therapy came in and the cocktail and people stopped dropping dead as much as they used to. I think for a lot of people, they just decided, well, okay, we're done here. You know, like AIDS is over and it's treatable and blah, blah, blah.
I think what happens is, though, that when you, I mean...
And admittedly, I'm sure we got burned out on just all the sort of, you know...
But think about it.
When I came out in the late 80s, it was all about AIDS, everything. Like all the music, all the theater, all the books.
You had to be, you know, paying attention.
Yeah, but it wasn't just about learning about safe sex and da-da-da. It permeated the culture, and it was all about memorial services. And like, I was young enough that I didn't really know a lot of people I knew a few, but not a lot. But everybody that I knew
close friends, good friends, friends,
you know.
People you were friendly with.
Yeah. And then, but obviously, everybody I knew who was 10, 20 years older than me. You know, the ones that were left, all their friends died, you know, and they were the ones sort of that. And that was why that was the culture that was trickling down to me as a young, newly out gay guy. But then once the mid 90s or so hit and the therapy popped up, it was like, all right, we're not talking about this for a while. And I think now we're starting to see that people are ready to talk about it again.
I have only ever had one actual friend die of it. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I know people who have died of it, like people who are, they were maybe friends of friends.
Sure.
But people that I was maybe friendly with that I didn't know especially well. But I've only ever had like a friend die of AIDS. Now, you and I have HIV positive friends.
Right.
Who are today living
healthy
and they're very healthy and they all have HIV. But even then, how many do we know? Maybe four or five friends that we know, people that we would consider our friends that have HIV?
At least.
Out of all the people we know?
Yeah, and they're the ones that we know because they mention it.
Yeah, you know? And so that's, I think, why you don't hear people talking about it so much anymore, because it's the demographics have shifted, and the specter of death is not hanging over anybody.
But I think there really is, you know, like Ms. Vachon said, there's a story to be told about an entire generation practically that was nearly wiped out, you know.
Right.
I mean, there's, you know, this year on HBO there was that the documentary about Fran Lebowitz that Martin Scorsese directed, and she talked about how like you wanted to be able to tell the people who died, you'll never guess who's famous.
Guess who has a career?
Yeah, and earlier I've heard her talk about how, like, you know, people don't understand, like, if you remove the gay and lesbian influence on popular culture, you're pretty much left with Let's Make a Deal.
She said that. Yes.
You know. So yeah, I mean, there's so many stories to be told just between the cultural impact and just what it's like to be the one person who, like, every single person that you know, or even like your acquaintances and stuff, all drop dead. You know, what becomes of your life? You know, what happens to you? So anyway, it's a really well made film, and I found it really moving, and people should totally go see it. It just opened in New York. And it's opening in L.A. this week. I imagine it'll be opening in San Francisco soon. It will be making its way around the country. We were here. Go see it.
Again, I do not have a DVD recommendation this week. I cannot think of anything.
My DVD recommendation
this week for this so that means I'm done.
You'll want to chime in on this, I'm sure. This is not a new DVD, but it ties into one of this week's movies. My DVD recommendation this week is Bronson.
Which is rad.
Which is rad. Which
an awesome movie.
Which stars Tom Hardy as the guy who beats up a lot of people.
Insanely violent.
Yes, and
like in a way that Warrior cannot be, because Warrior is a PG-13
film. Right, right.
Bronson is brutal.
But also very kind of engaging and funny, and stuff. Yes. And it's directed by Nicholas Winding Refn, whose new film Drive opens next week. So so it's a twofer. You should check out Bronson and get caught up on your Tom Hardy and your Nicholas because it's really terrific. As always, we got some emails this week, and we thank you for that. And you can like us on Facebook, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter, Linoleum Cast. And if you are a Get Glue subscriber, we are listed under TV shows for some reason.
Pointless.
But you can. Pointless. But people do it. It's nice. I appreciate it. So you know, click that you're listening to us. If you want to leave us a nice review at iTunes, those are always appreciated. And of course, check out our friends in the world of podcasts: Popcorn Mafia, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, yeah. Blowhard with Malcolm Ingram, The Podcast, The Criterion Cast, Fat Guys at the Movies, Secretly Timid, and Glitter in the Garbage. Anything else?
Bye.
Bye.